Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you haven't ordered your copy of Peter Hart's new book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, now is the time to do it. The Gallipoli Evacuation was one of the most important chapters of the entire Gallipoli story, and this is the first book to explore it in detail. From dithering politicians in London, to the winter storms, to the ingenious ruse that enabled the Allies to escape, such as the self-firing rifles and the silent periods, this book tells the whole gripping story of this life and death gamble. And Peter Hart really is the man to tell this story with his wonderful writing style, his insightful accounts of the history, and most importantly, his use of quotes from veterans of the campaign. The story of the Gallipoli evacuation is really told in the words of the men who were there. The book is now available in softcover or ebook, and you can order it all over the world and pay in your local currency. So visit our website, livinghistorytv.com, to order your copy today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History. This week marks the anniversary of a really important Australian battle in 1918. It's the Battle of Mons St. Quentin. Now, it's probably not a place that jumps to mind when you think of the First World War. There's many more famous battles than Mons St. Quentin. And it was a relatively small action by the scale of the First World War, but it was a really important one for the Australians. And this week, considering it's the anniversary, I thought it was the perfect opportunity to just break this battle down in a little bit more detail and dig into the history a bit more. And joining us to do that is one of our leading historians who leads our tours for Matt McLaughlin Battlefield Tours. It's Joe Hook. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Now, this battle took place in late August, early September 1918. Before we start looking in depth at the Battle of Mons St. Quentin, can you just give us an overview of what was happening at this stage in 1918?
Yeah, I think sort of like we have to go right back to Operation Michael, really, where the German army really stormed through British and Australian lines, tried to break the French and British at Amiens. And right up through the month of end of March through to April, there was sort of attack, follow counterattack, until eventually, as we know, sort of on the eve of Anzac Day 1918, the Australians, together with the British, managed to capture Villers-Bretonneux, retake that, and really from there on in, they were pushing further and further eastwards, pushing all the way and trying to almost keep in a straight line, keep in abreast of each other. And by this time, by the end of March, beginning of April, Monash is Anzac Corps commander, and we come through to July 1918 when he orchestrates his famous battle of La Hamel, which he predicted would be over in 90 minutes, slightly out, 3 minutes out, because it was over, done and dusted in 93 minutes. And really from then on, from July into August, as you know, 8th of August, known by Ludendorff, says this is the blackest day of the German army, because we are really starting to push forwards. Our tactics have changed, our methods have changed, And really throughout August, the Australians are fighting from the north to south, really eastwards on a line going forward, until by nearly the end of August, they reach the outskirts of Mont Saint-Quentin, the Bouchervins Ridge, which is a ridge line which lies near Mont Saint-Quentin, and the outskirts of the town of Peronne.
I think it's difficult to overstate what an effective fighting force the Australians had become by this stage of the war. I don't want to do this partisan thing where we say that Australia was the best troops on the ground, we won the war, all that rubbish that we go on with as Australians sometimes. But I think it is true to say that the Australians were as good as any of the British units. There were British units that were certainly as good as the Australians. The Canadians were excellent. The New Zealanders were excellent. There were many great fighting forces on the battlefield by this stage. But Australia certainly was at the top of that pile, weren't they?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And like you say, not to diminish anything, there were some very good British divisions. But the difference between the Australians and the Canadians to the British was that within their corps, divisions were shifted around. So, for example, if you were part of a British division, you might be in 4th Corps one day, and then the next month you'll be 5th Corps. This did not happen with the Australians, nor did it happen with the Canadians. So there was this national emphasis within the ANZAC Corps, with the Corps Command, that maintained this real nationality. And certainly by this time in the war, most of the divisional commanders underneath Monash were Australians and were experienced, battle-hardened divisional commanders, as were most brigade and battalion commanders.
It's a great point you make about cohesion, because being able to stay together and fight as a cohesive force, as you just mentioned, was a luxury that was not afforded to the British. It was something the Americans insisted on when they joined the war. It was something the Australians insisted on. The Canadians did. I mean, the New Zealanders were happy with their one division to be part of the British Army. But it meant that, as you say, we could fight as a unit, as a fighting force. We could learn from each other. Each battalion could learn about the other battalions. Each division could learn and fight together as a cohesive unit. And in addition, all the support forces, most of the support forces that we needed in terms of transport and pioneers and engineers and everything behind the scenes, were provided by Britain, weren't they? So it enabled the Australians to really just become this elite frontline fighting force.
Yeah, most definitely, that's correct. However, not forgetting that by this time in the war, this fighting force was quite greatly reduced because of the impetus of the two referendums for conscription. And also, when we're coming up to the fighting at specifically Mont Saint-Quentin and Peronne, these men have been fighting literally non-stop. And a vast majority of them are exhausted. So to just give you an example of one of the companies, A Company, of the 20th Battalion, normally would be something like 250 men strong as a company. It is down to just 82 men. But even then, it considers itself a strong company compared to other Australian companies.
Well, I certainly appreciate you mentioning the 20th, Joe, because that's the men from my hometown of West Wyalong in New South Wales were all 20th Battalion men. So I know that this battle was specifically very important to them in the district where I grew up. Just paint us a picture. Give us a bit of an overview of the geography. Why is this strange named place Mont Saint-Quentin? Why is this even important on the battlefield?
Well, it's quite difficult to describe without actually being on the ground. And when we come on a tour, obviously with Matt McLaughlin tours, we follow as closely, as you know, in the footsteps of the Australians. And so with the way we come up to Mont Saint-Quentin is via a town called Clary. Now, Clary sits on the Somme River, and the Somme kind of goes round in a curve and it joins the Canal du Nord. And as it comes round in a curve, we come through Clary, which needed to be taken by the Australians, the 3rd Australian Division, in order to capture Mont Saint-Quentin. And then we come over a ridge, and this is known as Bouchervins Ridge. And really, that the Bouchervins Ridge is the key to take in Mont Saint-Quentin, and then you drop down. And as you come into Peronne, you see to your left Mont Saint-Quentin, and it's something like 375 feet above sea level. But it is a dominant feature. And unless you take the Bouchevin's Ridge, that is the key to taking Mont Saint-Quentin. And unless you can take Mont Saint-Quentin, you can't take Peronne. So Mont Saint-Quentin really dominates to the north, to the south. And with the Germans being ensconced up there, they have really a complete view of the ground in front of them. So it was important that it was taken.
It's really important that we point out here the nature of the ground, because when we say ridge, people who haven't been there and walked the ground might be thinking a ridge like they would see in New Guinea on the Kokoda Track, or you know, some steep escarpment. It's not like that. It's rolling countryside. It's not flat, perhaps like Flanders further to the north. It's quite rolling farm country. But, I mean, we say Mont Saint-Quentin, it means mountain, but it's not really a mountain. It's just a hill. However, as you say, the perspective from that high ground is all important. And when we talk about the First World War, when we talk about important pieces of ground, we're often talking about high ground, aren't we?
Yes, yeah. I mean, for those of our clients that come on my tour, I do sort of bash on about high ground a bit. And this was something the Germans realised early on in the First World War. And so in 1914, when they would withdraw to positions, they would withdraw to high ground, just literally for the simple fact that if you hold the high ground, you can defend anything below you. And it makes much more difficult for attacking troops to attack uphill when they're facing something like artillery fire and withering machine gun fire that's literally spraying the battlefield. So any kind of high ground, whether it be, if you're in Flanders, whether you're on Hill 60 metres above sea level, or the undulating ground of the Somme battlefield, which is more rolling, as you quite rightly say, any high ground is important.
So how did the Australians come to be here facing this hill of Mont Saint-Quentin and the town of Peronne next to it?
Well, really, through fighting eastwards along the line of... There's an old Roman road that runs from Villers-Bretonneux, and if you follow it all the way along, you eventually get to Saint-Quentin, where the Australians would fight their last battle. But halfway along that road, and just really to the north of it, you have Peronne. And throughout that July and August, right up till the end of August, they're fighting, using this really as an axis of advance, taking little villages and towns as they are pushing the German army backwards and the German army are withdrawing, and using different tactics than really, forget the tactics that were used in 1916. This is a complete war now of movement, very, very difficult. And even Monash says that, you know, the kind of, preparatory bombardments that we had been used to in 1916, they're really, I'm not going to say old tactics, but now he believes that the success to attack is using Lewis guns and really a war of movement, using air power, tanks, cavalry as well.
It's a bit of a surprise that we hear the word cavalry in there, but cavalry in the First World War was really the only way that you could move quickly. And Lewis guns, of course, being the light machine guns that the Allies carried, were really important in this action. The one thing that I, from reading Monash's notes about this, I get the distinct impression that Monash, by this stage of the war, was really hungering for an Australian victory. I mean, the Australians had participated in lots of great victories, but even at places like Hamel, we attacked alongside the Americans. August 8 was a big Allied combined effort. Do you get the impression from reading about this that Monash was really hungry for a purely Australian victory at this time in the war?
I don't know whether he was hungry for a purely Australian victory, but I think he was buoyed on, and the essence to what he did, and I think even Rawlinson mentions this, although correct me if I'm wrong, was to keep the German army on the move so that they couldn't form any defensive lines and stop and reorganize. As long as you kept harrying them along, then you kept them on the move and you demoralised them. And I think that was the main thinking behind it. And certainly Ludendorff, when the German army sort of settled down at Mont Saint-Quentin and Peronne, he wanted them to hold that and form a defensive line there, whereas Monash quite correctly knew that you had to keep pushing them, you had to keep attacking them, until eventually you just wore them down.
So we're now in late August 1918. The Australians have been pushing the Germans back and back and back in their sector. The British have been, and the French and the Americans have also been pushing the Germans back as one long line. But in the Australian sector, the Australians have been pushing the Germans back every day since they started attacking in early August. Now they face the Somme River, this hill called Mont Saint-Quentin, and the town of Peronne. Let's talk about the battle. What happened on the 31st of August 1918?
Okay, well, initially in planning this attack, Monash knows that he's got various obstacles, namely waterways that he has to cross. These are all heavily guarded by the German army, and some of the bridges are even destroyed. So even before the battle plans, he has to change his initial plans in that two of his divisions, his third and his second division, he has to move them to the left in order to get them into position for the attack. And on the 30th of August, Monash, even in his own diaries, notes himself that progress is slow, because of heavy enemy opposition on the eastern banks of the Somme, and in attempts to take the village of Clary are being hampered by this. However, he plans the attack to start on the 31st of August, at 6 o'clock in the morning. And really, when I guide this particular battle, my main focus is on the 2nd Australian Division. So with the 2nd Australian Division, if we're standing there on the ground, our furthest battalion who are attacking is the 20th Battalion. To their left are the 17th Battalion, and then to their left, sorry, to their right are the 17th Battalion, and then to their right are the 19th Battalion, with the 18th Battalion in reserve. And what we've got to remember is that these battalions are extremely depleted and they're very, very tired. And even Charles Bean, the official historian, he almost doesn't think this is going to work because the Australians are so tired. Yet on that morning of the 31st of August, Monash doesn't use a creeping barrage. They have kind of like the artillery will target certain positions on Mont Saint-Quentin and lay down artillery fire and then lift. But literally the Australians are reliant on their Lewis gunners, rifle grenades, bombers going forward. And so without a preparatory bombardment, they negate that. The Germans are left not knowing really what's going to happen. So normally when we attacked in 1916, 1917, we would have a preparatory bombardment. And really all that would tell the Germans was that we were going to attack. This time we didn't do that. And literally on that first morning, as we stand on the battlefield, we stand along the path where the 17th Battalion attacked, going towards Mont Saint-Quentin. And such is the sheer impetus of the attack that the Germans are taken completely by surprise. The Australians, according to the accounts that you read, charge up to the German positions, literally with bayonets fixed, Lewis gunners throwing themselves down, the rifle grenades firing into German positions, and they are screaming at the top of their voices. So for a lot of the Germans, this gives them the idea that actually more men are attacking than they are at the time. And certainly that initial attack on the 31st, they don't reach the top of Mont Saint-Quentin, but they get quite far forward in order to literally, you know, the German army at this stage is in disarray. And I think Jack Sheldon mentions in his book about, you know, some of these German machine gun positions are so surprised that they don't even have time to man their machine guns before the Australians are on top of them.
It's interesting that my favourite quote of this that people, when they come to Mont St. Quentin, love hearing is that the instruction was given that the Australians should yell like bushrangers as they charged up the slope. And I'm just trying to imagine, if you're a poor German machine gunner and the ferocious Australians charging up the slope, what that must have been like. It must have been some pretty tough fighting. There was a second phase of the battle, though, wasn't there? On the 31st of August, they captured a large portion of the Mont. But then the Germans did what Germans always do, and they counterattacked in strength. So tell us about the counterattack and then the second phase of the battle.
Yeah, you're correct. They did counterattack. And so I believe they made no less than 10 counterattacks. And what they did, they didn't totally... some accounts will tell you they pushed the Australians right back to virtually their starting positions. From what I believe, they didn't do this. And various elements of the 17th Battalion and the 20th Battalion to their left held their positions. But what the Germans did was that they managed to infiltrate between them. Their idea was to split the battalions and then literally to encircle them and destroy them there. So they did counterattack, and the Australians received quite a lot of casualties during this counterattack. But Monash wasn't going to let it lie there, and he would arrange for the 6th Brigade of the Australian 2nd Division. Literally on the 1st of September, he sends out another order, and they are to, virtually following the footsteps of the 5th Brigade, go through them and exploit any positions that the 5th Brigade had taken. And one of the great accounts that I always talk about when we're at Mont St. Quentin is a fabulous diary. And this diary is written by a guy called Percy Smythe. And he's 24th Battalion, Percy Smythe. And I always mention him because I show our clients a picture of him, and he's if you're a young lady in Perone, I'm sure you would have made eyes for Percy Smythe because he's a very good looking officer. But he talks about coming up to their jumping off position, but also having to deal with the casualties from the German counterattack. So he talks about dealing with them. He talks about some of the things that are quite grisly, having to sort of literally cut somebody's arm off with a blunt penknife, having to deal with the dead and the wounded, and also collecting the personal effects of the dead who are lying in the trenches as they're coming up through and preparing for their attack, and identifying them. And he gives this fascinating account of trying to identify this one sergeant who's gone with them through Gallipoli, through all their time on the Western Front. And eventually they managed to identify this sergeant through a letter he's received from his mother, and that identifies him. But his diary, it's there for people to see. You can look it up. When I was doing my research, when I first started working for you, Matt, it was one of the diaries I thought was so eloquently put. And also he carries on to tell you about the attack, and he mentions certain positions on the battlefield. There's an old cemetery. He mentions the sunken lane. And if you go to the battlefield today, they're still there. So there's still that tangible evidence that you can relate directly back to Charlie Smythe's diary of the attack on Mont St. Quentin.
So let's talk about the closing stages of the battle. So the 6th Brigade's come up. They've pushed through where the 5th Brigade had held the line against the German counterattacks. Tell us about 6th Brigade completing the capture of the Mont.
Okay, so so once 6th Brigade initially... when they come through the 5th Brigade, they're being held up by a German machine gun nest. And there's one young man who's acting as a runner. His name's McAteer. I can't remember off the top of my head whereabouts he came from in Australia. But he realises the position is being held up. He single-handedly takes out this German machine gun prison. I think about 20 Germans surrender. He goes on to take another one and then goes on to take a third where he's killed. Now, he would be awarded a Victoria Cross. But what he does do is open the way forward for the Australians to attack. And very much like the previous day's attacks, you have Lewis gunners throwing themselves forward, men firing rifle brigades. And the thing with firing rifle grenades, is that they have a high trajectory and they have high explosive. So if you fire them onto German positions, the Germans hopefully will bolt. And where they will bolt, the Lewis gunners will throw themselves down and literally mow any enemy down as they bolt from their positions. And this happens and keeps happening until the Australians literally almost run into their own barrage, and the whole attack is stalled at about 1:30 that afternoon. They realise they can't get any further forward, so they call up another artillery barrage. The brigade commander, Robertson, I think his name is, calls up for an artillery barrage. This goes in, and the 23rd and 24th battalions again attack forward. They're being held up by a quarry on the northern side of Mont Saint-Quentin. And men initially from the 21st Battalion, who were in reserve but have been brought into the positions, they attack the quarry, try to disperse the machine gun nests there and are unable to do so, have to fall back. And they fall back to a position where there's a guy called Sergeant Albie Lowison. And Lowison reorganises his group, and they attack again forward, literally with grenades. One man going up, throwing the grenade in, falling back, then another throwing another grenade in, falling back, and so on until this carries on. And I think Lowison has only about six men with him before eventually they rush the machine gun nest and capture that on the Mont. And while all this is going on as well, the 6th Brigade have, as part of supporting them, they have the men of the 2nd Machine Gun Company of the 2nd Australian Machine Gun Battalion. And part and parcel of this battalion is a man called Towner. Now, Towner is described by Charlie Smythe as a very cool, calm, collected, extraordinary individual. And he will go forward. He captures German machine guns single-handedly using his revolver. And using German machine guns, he eventually manages to put them in defensive positions. So he uses the captured German machine guns. Towner's already been wounded. He's taken a wound which has pierced his helmet and has grazed his skull. But he still continues supporting the men of the 23rd and 24th battalions. And what he doesn't tell them, and in the accounts that I've read, that he would single-handedly recce forward to find better tactical positions for his machine guns. But together with machine guns, with the men going forward, using these new tactics, using their Lewis guns, using their grenades, they eventually manage to take Mont Saint-Quentin. The German army fall back. But once Mont Saint-Quentin has actually been taken, this then leaves the 7th Brigade, who will eventually exploit forward from Mont Saint-Quentin along that ridge, pushing the Germans ever further eastwards. By taking the Mont, though, what it does allow them to do is at the same time, the 5th Australian Division is beginning their attack in Peronne. And once Mont-Saint-Quentin has been taken, it denies the enemy the dominance of that hill, and allows the 5th Australian Division to consequently and at the same time take the town of Peronne.
I'd forgotten that detail you just mentioned, Joe, that in Edgar Towner's Victoria Cross action that he was putting German machine guns into use. And I was reading that this was actually part of Australian doctrine and British doctrine as well, that they knew that as they swept forward, as they captured positions from the Germans, they were going to capture German machine guns. And the German machine guns were the same basic principle as the Vickers guns that they used in the British and Australian forces, but slightly different. So they trained their machine gunners on how to use the German guns as well, so that as they swept forward and captured German guns, they could then bring those to use against the Germans themselves. I love that detail. It's quite an extraordinary facet of the battle.
Yeah, I mean, Towner for me is... his action, and if you see a picture of Towner, unfortunately we don't have a picture because this is a podcast, but if you just look at the picture of him, he's this extraordinary man who just looks cool, calm and collected. And Smythe, in his diary, he even describes him as this man who was very quiet, very stoic, but just knew his job. I think quite a humble man who would probably, and this is just my guesstimate, would have been awarded the VC, but would have probably totally amazed that he was awarded a Victoria Cross for what he believed he was just doing his job.
Now, the Battle of Mont-Saint-Quentin, after it was over, and the 5th Division did a great job capturing Peronne as well in some very bitter hand-to-hand fighting. Afterwards, it was lauded as one of the greatest Australian achievements of the war, that this ragtag, understrength group of Aussies had captured these two quite formidable positions. Do you see that it's one of the greatest Australian achievements of the war?
I think for the Australians it was, yes, definitely. When you think about it, this was an all Australian battle. Although on their flanks you did have British divisions, but Mont-Saint-Quentin itself, the capture of the Mont, and Peronne was totally all Australian. And they came under, the Anzac Corps at the time came under the Fourth Army. A Fourth Army commander was a guy called Rawlinson, and even Rawlinson said himself it was one of the greatest feats of the war that he'd seen. So that's from the commander of the Fourth Army, British officer Rawlinson, even he said this.
Now, Joe, one of the things that you and I most love to do is to obviously walk the ground, and I think you get such a wonderful perspective on what was achieved when you actually get out there and strap the boots on and walk the ground. I always love visiting Mont-Saint-Quentin. I've been going there for nearly 20 years now. Just tell us about what you can still see on the ground there today, because, I mean, even given the situation we're currently in, I'm desperate to get back over there, and hopefully eventually I will be able to. There's nothing quite like walking the ground, though, is there?
No, I agree with you. And your desperation is echoed here in England, believe you me. So I like Mont-Saint-Quentin as well, because I think it's one of the, certainly for the British, it's very understated, because I think it's all Australian. I think the reason I know it so well is that all of our clients are predominantly Australian. We get the occasional New Zealander. I've even had Americans on a Matt McLaughlin tour, but predominantly Australian. So not a lot of the Brits go down there. There's not really a cemetery to see, and it hasn't been commercialised. So when you come up through Cleary, which is obviously Cleary was a town on the banks of the River Somme, had to be taken. You can see, you can point out Mont-Saint-Quentin. So immediately you can give passengers, you have an idea of what a dominant feature it was. And we always come up and we drop off our passengers at the 2nd Australian Division Memorial, but we don't start there. We walk down the road from there, and you can walk onto the very tracks where Smythe attacked with his battalion. And if you've got, I use a gadget, which I'm sure you will know of, but probably a lot of our passengers don't know of, called Linesman. And basically this is a mapping system that puts trench maps onto a tablet. and you can actually follow them using GPS. So I always get this out, and you can see the trenches of the German trenches, Gottlieb Trench, Elsa Trench, all of which are mentioned in the accounts. And so the track we're on, you can see it was originally there as a German trench at the time. Now, when we come down from the memorial, we turn right up a little road, little side road. And I know that you know, Matt, exactly where I'm talking about. But if you follow that road down, you come to a civilian cemetery. Now, that cemetery is mentioned in Smythe's war diary. The sunken road in which Towner is, you can still see it on the battlefield. So that's very, very tangible evidence of the battle that took place there. And we will quite often walk up a road that runs parallel to the main road. It's a little side road and it's called Labby, meaning the Abbey Road. And in the side of that road, you can see what is left of the old 7th century abbey remnants. Now, prior to the First World War, there was an old abbey at Mont-Saint-Quentin that goes back to the 7th century. And if you're very careful and you look very, very closely, in that abbey wall is still a shell, still right embedded within the abbey wall. So that always is worth a photo stop. For all our passengers, they're always told not to touch it, but please, you can take photos if you want to. And then if you walk right up to the top of Mont Saint-Quentin, you used to be able to, you can't do so now because it's all fenced off, I think because they've had so many battlefield visitors, but you used to actually be able to walk in what was the old trench systems. You can still see the quarry there where Loison was awarded his VC for the action there. So it still is visible for anybody who goes up there to have a look and see. Obviously, it's easier with a guide that knows the history, but there is still tangible evidence on that battlefield of the actions that took place there over 100 years ago.
It's disappointing they've got that area fenced off, because I always said that it was one of the great unmaintained original trench system that you could find on the Western Front. There were trenches through there, shell holes. You can still see them from the other side of the fence, but you can't walk in them now. It's probably good for preservation that people can't walk in there and damage them, but it is quite a remarkable sight. And of course, the Australian Memorial there, the 2nd Division Memorial, which depicts a digger, you know, an Australian soldier standing on a plinth. That's got quite an interesting history as well, doesn't it? Tell us about the Australian 2nd Division Memorial.
It has got a very interesting history. And I actually like it because it's different, as you know, from all the other divisional memorials, which are all that, like this kind of obelisk shape. But the original memorial, it was quite a controversial memorial because it depicted a digger bayoneting an eagle. Now, to the German army, certainly the German army of the Second World War, the eagle is symbolic to them. So they took it very, very harshly that this memorial should be an Australian soldier literally bayoneting something that was so symbolic to them. So the actual memorial itself was destroyed, although the plinth remained as it is. So today you see a much more, shall we say, politically correct memorial of an Australian soldier facing the way that the attack that was going in towards Mont Saint-Quentin. And that was erected, I think it was in the 1970s. But the plinth on which it stands is the original, just the memorial has been changed. And quite a lot of times when the Australians, I have the original, the picture of the original memorial, and you look at it and it is quite aggressive, and surprisingly quite a few of them turn around and say to me, you know, Joe, I can imagine that would be create some sort of animosity, certainly in the 1940s in the Second World War.
It's certainly reflective of the attitude of the Australian veterans, wasn't it, that they felt when the 2nd Division, each of the five Australian divisions chose a spot to build their memorial after the war, and the Australians from the second division chose Mons and Quentin, and the way they wanted to depict their great victory there was showing a German eagle being bayoneted on the ground. It certainly did reflect their feelings about the accomplishment of taking Mons and Quentin. But it's just such an arresting memorial. When people go there today, when Australians go there and see this just huge, looming digger just standing there proud, it is really a wonderful Australian sight on the battlefields, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we quite often, as you well know, when we do tours to the Western Front, it's a great place to take a group photograph. And also it has all the panels around it, so you can spend time. And everything around it depicts this kind of the feat that was accomplished by the Australians. The avenue it sits in is called Avenue des Les Australiens, excuse my French. And there is this kind of, nature of the accomplishment that happened there.
Well, Joe, it's a very special battlefield. It's wonderful that on these anniversaries, we can look at perhaps these lesser well-known chapters of Australian history and tell these stories, because it's important we remember them. And walking the ground with you is one of the great privileges that people have. So I'm looking forward to the tours getting up and running again so that people can return and walk the ground with you, Joe, because you are one of our most popular historians who leads our tours. But thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about Mons and Quentin.
It's a pleasure. And hello to everybody in Australia. I hope I'm out touring with you very soon. Let's all pray for a vaccine.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.